So thank you all for joining today. And beyond survival, displacement, rights, and well-being by the Humanitarian Policy Group, which forms a broader part of ODI. We are doing a hybrid event, so please bear with us as we try and navigate person dynamics. For those online, have Arabic translation. If you're in the room and need Arabic translation, so we're going to present three pieces of research today with colleagues that I will introduce briefly now, and then as they each pieces have Nadia Siddiqui, who is the co-director of social inquiry, who's been partnering with HPG on some research around well-being in northeast Syria. Have Alex Spencer, who is a and she'll be presenting a well-being policy brief that zooms out from the northeast Syria case study. And joining online as well, we have Dean Fuad, who will be presenting an even bigger global picture around an IDP review that HPG has been doing UN, the ISAC. So what the order of events, we're going to hear from Nadia first to kind of go from the quite macro granular level around northeast Syria. Then we're going to shift over to Alex, who's well-being research project has been so that's it. It's going to be a lot of content to take in, but we will share QR codes during the presentation, which you'll what we'll also send out feedback forms on your tables, and you'll also receive a link online. We welcome feedback. As we all know, donors love feedback. So if you have no, do whatever you will, that's fine. Cool. So without further ado, we will get started. And from online, unfortunately, both Nadia and Lean, we had a few difficulties for Jordan. So this is all in-person event, but unfortunately, but it is a hybrid event, so cool. So without further ado, I will hand over to Nadia, who is the co-director of Social Inquiry.
Thanks, Dustin. Good morning or afternoon, everybody. As I said, I'm Nadia, and I'll be presenting today very briefly, I hope, so we can have more discussion on this. A deeper look at well-being and aspirations in northeast Syria in the shadow of revolution and the humanitarian response, because as we'll see, the response doesn't quite reach everywhere. And in some ways, neither did the revolution quite pick up. So, next slide, please. Oh, okay. So, our case study is a case study of well-being stalled a bit, despite people's best efforts. We focused in northeast Syria. We wanted to look at well-being through place, community, and aspirations among residents and IDPs in Qamishli. The focus was on an urban non-camp setting. That was by choice, partly to not overlap with the other case study that was part of this wider project, and also because there, especially within NESS, there tends to be a little bit less focus on some on urban areas, as opposed to camps and detention facilities. And we focused here because it is a site of protracted crisis and displacement, and it has a response for that. But it's also seated within the Kurdish state building project of the Autonomous Administration of North and East Syria. I think the name is different now, but so we wanted to look at sort of how these different threads intersected with people's lives and their well-being. Next slide, please. Just quickly, we're discussing well-being, and this is a very sort of quick definition, as a process not just of people seeking to survive and to live, but to do so even in difficult conditions, even in crisis, in ways that they believe have meaning and value. So we wanted to sort of understand what that meaning and value is for people and how they go about trying to achieve it, even in conditions of protracted crisis and displacement. Next slide, please. We approached well-being sort of in three broad categories, exploring sort of place and material conditions. So understanding basic needs, public services, aid, livelihoods, through relationships, understanding how people celebrate holidays, especially in such a diverse place as Qamishli, their sense of belonging, norms, and freedoms, especially as those have changed over time, as the self-administration has sort of taken shape, and public participation. And finally, sort of the more subjective elements, their aspirations, what is important for people to pursue flourishing lives? What do they need? What are issues that are preventing them from having that? Where have they experienced security and comfort? So this is what we spoke about, focusing really on these three dimensions and not using the word well-being in Arabic or Kurdish per se, because it does have some negative connotations, or focusing specifically only on service provision. So we sort of widened the scope of what we're looking at. Next slide, please. I'm not going to give an overview of Syria, but just to say that just based on this map, it's complicated. The lines of control, who's operating where. I mean, all of this shapes not only how people live, where they can move, where they displace to, but also what types of assistance they have, where does aid go, who is providing it. And just to sort of say that this is complicated, Qamishli is no different. Next slide, please. And here, just placing Qamishli sort of a little bit more into context. It is bordering with Turkey. It's the largest big area, like close to the Iraq border as well. It has a mix of local institutions as well as government of Syria institutions and pockets. The aid response is also a lot of local organizations. Local NGOs are based in Qamishli, although they work elsewhere. The humanitarian response itself is sort of run by INGOs, is coordinated that way. And so people are navigating multiple sort of spheres between self-administration institutions, government of Syria institutions, and then whatever sort of is available within the humanitarian response that often doesn't reach Qamishli. And sort of are surrounded by these sort of ambient threats of Turkey, of the government of Syria, and also ISIS sort of further away. Next slide, please. And so this is a very complicated place. It's a very tough place to live, but we wanted to sort of unpack, okay, so what matters to people? What is well-being for people in Qamishli? Because I think when we initially started this work, there was a lot of thinking around, well, like, the place is a very hard place to live. It's difficult. There's, water shortages, there's all of this. Do people even consider these other things, in a place that's so tough to be in? And they do. And so when we talked about it was material needs, but it was more than that. It was about accessing rights. People were really, the emerging themes came out that were important to people were of agency, choice, and self-sufficiency. So being able to avail themselves of what's available in a way that they felt was meaningful, that they could make decisions that impacted their lives and their children's lives. I think this was very important, was to make sure that their kids were okay. Having economic opportunities, the right to work, the ability to provide, and also cultural and community engagement and public participation, being part of something, being able to have bonds with other people was really important and is fraying. I mean, that's sort of a common theme. So these were sort of the three main dimensions that came out in terms of what it meant to live well in for people in commissioning, displaced or otherwise. Next slide, please. So what we sort of understood of well-being in a place like this was that it included both a collective sense of purpose and an individual sense of place within their society. And people described this as having occurred in different points in time. So the first quote you see is from a woman, a displaced woman from, I believe, Afrin. And for her, the time was in the sort of initial stages of the revolution early on, when they were starting to form their community and their new government structures, and even like ordinary citizens were involved in this process. It was very important, and it entailed developing institutions, but also providing for each other and having intellectual and cultural outlets of expression as well. It's very important. For the next person, the next quote, that was before the. It predated the crisis. That was when they felt the most sense of flourishing and well-being, where they could travel, where they could go, where they could organize activities for themselves, have jobs, and not really think that they needed to be anywhere up but Syria. And the third person hasn't experienced that at all in the context of either Qamishli or Syria as a whole. And so there hasn't been a space where they have felt that they could flourish. And so it's interesting to sort of see these different dynamics in a place. Qamishli is very diverse. We interviewed people who are Kurds, Arabs, Christians, Yazidi, and that the population isn't homogenous in terms of its views either of where they've experienced well-being. But what is sort of a common trend is what matters to have well-being. Next slide, please. One of the main sort of other findings was that people did not feel, regardless of their opinion about, the governance structures or, living conditions, with that currently, it is the current conditions in Qamishli, the status quo is not conducive for well-being, and it erodes what was there. And this is because of its uncertainty as a state. It doesn't have political, the self-administration doesn't have political international recognition, but there is, but it's not also clear what will happen in the future. There's no political settlement either. There's no sort of agreement on what should happen to this place, how it will be run going, in the long term, I guess. And so while there isn't an agreement amongst people about what that structure should be, there's a lot of different views in Qamishli that sort of span that follow along identity lines, but also there's divisions within. What's clear is that the current status quo is unsustainable and likely to worsen. At the same time, people recognize that Qamishli is also, compared to the rest of the country and the rest of Ness, better off than other places. So as difficult as it is, it's better than elsewhere, and they recognize that. And that is also what's drawing more people to Qamishli. So it's becoming a much more crowded place. There's a lot of migration. There's a lot of out-migration and displacement. There's also a lot of people coming in, and it's sort of combining to make a very, very sort of difficult place to live in a context where it's not quite clear what is actually supposed to happen to it. Next slide, please. So this is basically life in an unrecognized de facto state. Most people agree that the service provision and most of the aid is coming from the self-administration. There's very little international aid actually directed to Qamishli. It is sent out elsewhere within Northeast Syria, particularly in areas that have been retaken from ISIS. So the focus is not here. And so people have to sort of grapple with what the state can provide, and it can't reach everywhere, partly because of historical neglect of these areas, but also it doesn't have the resources to do so. So everything is very difficult. It's also facing all of the sanctions and economic issues that Syria as a whole is facing. People have to grapple between self-administration institutions, government of Syria institutions, and have to make choices that are not In an ideal setting, these wouldn't be options. They would usually probably pick any of these options. But I think Alex will talk about this in more detail. While they have greater freedom, while there are new structures for public participation, not everybody uses them, not everybody feels comfortable with them. It does the state doesn't isn't able to reach to sort of make people use them. These are issues that also local civil society pointed out that need to be strengthened if and the diversity of the population's views needs to be better incorporated into how things are structured so that more people can participate. Local integration of IDPs is limited because of this. Return as an option for displaced people is just not on the table for many of them because of where they can't go back and live under the forces that are currently controlling their areas. So there's a lot of fear, uncertainty, hopelessness, and resentment because they also see aid. There's a lot of aid that sort of comes through commercially but doesn't stay because it's part of the border. So like they're not seen as being prioritized in a response that's very constrained itself. And so people feel that migration is the only option for their futures in the absence of political recognition or settlement. And this is even people who are very actively involved in the state building process. It's not that they would necessarily want to leave, but they don't see opportunities for safety for their children. And so a lot of agency is exerted as much as they can in trying to ensure safety, opportunity, and actual choice for their children. And that was a big focus was what is here for my kids? And if it's not here, we have to do something else. Next slide, please. And so this has been kind of because there isn't a settlement, it shows the sort of the limitations of using humanitarian aid to mitigate conflict in an unrecognized de facto state. The state structures coordinate with the international response, like there is coordination, but access doesn't, it doesn't really reach commercially. There's a lot of local organizations headquartered in commercially that do small projects in the city and want to work there, but most of the funding and resources is sent elsewhere because it's deemed not conflict affected enough, which is a point of contention for a lot of people because yes, it wasn't, didn't have the ISIS occupation, but it has experienced quite a lot of conflict and threat. And people's experiences are not reflected in this sort of a structure. And so the response structure itself and its implementation is seen by local authorities, civil society, and the community as reinforcing past and ongoing marginalization of Kurdish majority areas. In speaking with people who are part of the international response, I think they recognize that, but feel tied, hamstrung in terms of what they can do because of restrictions on where limited resources can go. And as such, the aid response is linked directly to survival. In talking to everybody about this, like it's not designed to be to support flourishing lives because it can't, and it is hamstrung similarly, same way people are by a lack of political recognition or settlement of the Ness areas. So I think there's a recognition from everybody that things could be better if they could work more closely with authorities or they could sort of ex be able to cover more areas. But there seems to be, they can't basically. People themselves are hamstrung by sort of the geopolitics and the responses as well. Next slide, please. So, in the absence of a political solution resolution, in the absence of that, how to help support people to be able to lead flourishing lives when they have reached sort of their limit in being able to? They've tried and they are, but it's hard. And so, from this work, we had seen that like this does call for engagement and more thinking about how to directly engage with de facto state authorities in service provision and system strength. Strengthening to sort of meet the needs of more people. People we interviewed seemed, especially on the humanitarian response side, seemed willing to do it, but were sort of tied by donor restrictions. But there could be, and there should be more thinking about how to push these bounds of what's there to meet these needs. Implement conflict-sensitive communication and prioritization. Again, the notion that a place isn't conflict sensitive enough is very hurtful to people. It undermines their own experiences And it seems to sort of make them, it starts drawing these comparisons between communities as well. And it brings out resentments that don't necessarily, that don't need to be exacerbated. And so coming up with ways to better prioritize and speak about these issues to communities, to the response, to authorities, it needs to be prioritized. In the absence of any solutions here, multi-year funding and program cycles that that encompass more communities need to be considered and need to be applied here. People need help. The authorities need help in expanding their reach to cover more people. And so this is really important. Leveraging different resources, some possibly pooling humanitarian and stabilization funds together, pooling resources in an already like sort of constrained setting to reach more places, using municipal and sub-state funds was has been we discovered some options that the self-administration has explored and to actually do some of the infrastructure strengthening that is needed. And finally, and I think most importantly, is to invest in institutional strengthening and in local NGOs. I mean, in speaking with civil society in Commissley, they know the needs of their community. They want to work in their community and they can't, but they know how to, and they want to bridge the divides between the institutions and people and sort of help push, like move this hopelessness and push forward more space for flourishing. So I'll stop here.
Thanks for that tour de force, Nadia. I just want to first check because I hear there were some connectivity issues when I was speaking last time. So just right. So you've got the QR code. All right. Now we're going to get an echo. How is that line? Apologies for the technical complications. We are getting good connection in the room, at least. So, yeah, so I'll reset. Nadia, thanks for that excellent presentation. I think you touched upon a lot of like very poignant and very timely issues facing, growing escalation of conflict in various settings, these inabilities to engage with unrecognized state actors, also these pressures on a lot of humanitarian systems, funding cuts after many years of a lot of funding growth for humanitarian response in recent years. But now a lot of organizations and responses are really facing a lot of struggles as funding shifts or just declines in many contexts. So we will save questions and discussion until the very end because I think we could talk for hours about each presentation. So we'll shift over to Alex, who's going to present this kind of zooming out a bit from Northeast Syria specifically to also draw on a case study that we have done around long-term displacement of Myanmar, particularly Karen refugees based in Thailand. And again, I think this is rings and connects to what Nadia was talking about as well of, Myanmar is currently undergoing a revolution against authoritarian and violent rule. And you have a lot of non-recognized state actors, both ethnic armed administrations, but also the National Unity Government. And there's a lot of tension in Myanmar and globally about the lack of political engagement with these non-recognized actors and the importance of being able to effectively engage with them both on political levels, but also in terms of humanitarian response. So I think those issues that Nadia brought out is a really good segue for Alex to now talk little bit on Thailand, but kind of zooming out more around the policy brief on well-being. So I'll hand over to Alex, who is a research officer with Humanitarian Policy Group. Thanks.
That might help online, but please flag if you can't hear me very well. If you could just move me on to the next slide. So I won't spend too long here because I think Dustin has already talked you through the publications for this project. But just to say, kind of today and the policy brief that we're launching alongside the case study is the culmination of a 2-year research project into well-being in protected crises. And again, like Dustin said, despite all of the contextual specificities with the situation and the case study in Thailand and also the one in Syria, the findings and the implications of these carry kind of broader relevance for humanitarian things. And I'm going to try and present some of those. You'll have seen this quote before, but I just want to build on Nadia's presentation a little bit to pull the concept of well-being a little bit more deeply, explain a little bit about how and why it's relevant for humanity. As I've mentioned, people strive not to exist, but to live in ways that they believe bring value. And that we mean that being able to address material needs is, of course, important, but to live good, meaningful, and flourishing lives goes beyond really surviving. Well-being includes subjective perceptions about what's important, as well as geographical, social, and moral elements. For example, through a sense of place, feeling of being part of a community, or aspirations that someone has. And often this understanding tends to be at odds with humanitarian systems that prioritize the provision of. But this utilitarian and top-down approach often deems these broader issues of well-being as slightly beyond the scope or capacity of humanitarian resources and systems. Consequently, humanitarian assistance often overlooks large parts of people's existence, things like culture or education, work, sport, religion, sex, relationships, or even having a basic sense of agency and control. Sometimes that's led to crisis-affected people repeatedly stressing that aid fails to consider the most pressing needs and priorities. Yes, whilst there have been sectoral improvements over the years through cross-cutting mental health and psychosocial support and responsibility to affected populations, often efforts to enhance well-being have been constrained by political factors. And often, when politics and principles collide, well-being suffers. So, why is this important to humanitarian actors and programming? And why do we need to kind of understand and apply a holistic approach to well-being? Well, without it, there's a potential for ineffective or wasted programming. It doesn't properly grasp or integrate the complex and interconnected priorities of people's lives. It risks causing significant and lasting, although unintended harm when humanitarian programming actively undermines affected people's efforts to re-establish what they perceive as normal lives. And lastly, opportunities for humanitarian actors to more effectively support wider well-being can be missed. I'll double check because I can see everyone moving around, but we can hear okay. Quite a lot of quotes that we've collected on the slide from the research. Ultimately, these basically have pointed us towards the fact that the rights to work, education, and movement are all really paramount to well-being, yet are often neglected by humanitarian actors. And so we're suggesting that a rights-focused agenda must be reinvigorated. Said before, well-being is linked not just to immediate material needs, subjective experience, or relations with their communities, but ultimately sits within a wider political landscape of rights upheld or rights denied. So I'll just reference some of the quotes on the slides. We have one here about being able to express one's culture, dress, and customs, particularly in a context where these have previously been denied. Obviously taken from the Northeast Syria case study and a Kurdish resident of Qamishli. But also there's reference to being able to move, The quote from James here on the slide suggests that they're refugees. They don't have money to go out, don't have a card to go out. And without these ability to move, feel like they don't necessarily have an identity. And the last one, which I think is really interesting, and it speaks to a lot of what Nadia said before about people's well-being being really centered on the size of their children and the ability of their children and imparting kind of well-being now or well-being in the future, is this quote about schools. And this came up quite heavily in the research about how some people in northeast Syria were forced to make this choice between which form of education they would like to send their children to. Do they send them to local schools, or do they send them to government of Syria run schools? They run the risk themselves of potentially losing their job if they send their child to the government of Syria schools, but not having that international recognition meant that their child maybe didn't have the future that they wanted for themselves. So there was this choice, kind of being able to express and their identity and supporting the state building project in northeast Syria, but also recognizing that it doesn't give all of the opportunities that they might well want. So in summary, freedom of expression, education, work and movement were all very central to well-being. And this is particularly notable at a time when rights are increasingly challenged as part of the basis of humanitarian response, and dwindling aid budgets are driving calls for prioritization and back to basics needs-based approaches. Without these rights, interviewees reported a pervasive sense of feeling stuck, with minimal possibility to improve their prospects, either through better livelihood opportunities or the opportunity for onward migration. And this feeling of hopelessness further undermined their well-being. The right to work and freedom, like I said, work and freedom of movement are really intricately connected to education issues. Like I said, it's broadly seen as the key to shaping a better future for children, their families, and the community as a whole. It's viewed as a means to impart well-being now and in the future to live flourishing lives. And I know, I guess, sort of a little bit what the easy response to this is. Such limitations often kind of extend beyond the natural remit of humanitarian actors and often represent a constant tension between humanitarian donors and implementers. But they must be addressed as part of a broader well-being approach. Not only is there a role for humanitarian actors to advocate for changes in restrictive host government policies, but there's also a need to look to the role of livelihood programming in humanitarian. So the foregrounding of rights also extends to affected populations wanting influence over the decisions that impact their lives. Findings clearly relate back to participation and agency, with many of the factors negatively impacting the lives of affected people being far beyond their control. Whilst interviewees have learned to navigate the humanitarian response or that lack thereof in some cases, the dual governance systems and public services and the legal restrictions placed on them, life decisions are very often motivated by determining and pursuing the least bad outcome. This is in contrast to asking for and attaining things that they really would like to make their life more meaningful and fulfilling. Another example of this that came up quite prominently in the research was in reference to documentation, needing a passport to migrate onwards, but choosing not to go out and access them, either because of the cost of doing so or the risk of doing so and traveling to areas that might put them at a greater risk. And relatedly, interviewees in both northeast Syria and Thailand valued opportunity to influence humanitarian decision making, specifically on decisions around aid prioritization. Conclusions from these discussions, on the other hand, often exacerbated a sense of hopelessness and loss of control. People need to have a say in the decisions that impact their lives and be better informed as to why they're not being supported in the ways they believe are necessary. And again, that kind of links back a little bit to what Nadia was saying on the people, the participants from Northeast Syria expressing quite deep hurt at not being considered conflict affected enough to receive regular international assistance. Of prioritization happens. Do you kind of experience the ongoing military in Turkey? There's a bit of a disconnect. So humanitarian actors may not be able to immediately address the systemic barriers to well-being highlighted by the research, but they are able to substantially improve affected populations' participation in aid decision making and implementation. A commitment to well-being also entails designing interventions in ways that expand agency. And in expanding this agency, it's really important to note that a commitment to well-being is not just kind of a top-level commitment to AAP. It goes beyond kind of those simple measures on complaint mechanisms, needs assessments, and providing basic information to populations. Of course, they're necessary, but not necessarily sufficient to really kind of get into the level that people are asking for. So really there's an ask to go beyond the basics and truly engage people in decision-making while also being transparent about how decisions are made. In that sense, a well-being approach doesn't necessarily require more resources, but a more deliberate allocation that ensures that affected people. Lastly, I'm just going to try and summarize very quickly some recommendations that came out of the study. Firstly, that donors and implementing agencies must renew and sustain efforts to address structural impediments to improve well-being. So despite the difficulties in securing such systemic changes, humanitarian actors must sustain advocacy and policy initiatives to address such barriers to improve well-being. The alternative is often kind of standing still, inertia, which in turn compounds affected people's sense of hopelessness. Secondly, donors and implementing agencies should integrate a well-being approach into their strategies and and to do so, there's lessons that can be drawn from effective AAP initiatives and emphasizing the importance of collective well-being. Ultimately, a well-being approach requires humanitarian actors to understand and address affected people's preferences, aspirations, and perceived impediments to well-being, looking beyond just individuals or households to really address the communal elements. Donors must also dramatically expand multi-year and flexible funding, and if possible, with specific allocations for bettering the well-being of affected populations. And that's important to that it should be directed by affected populations to address their specific priorities and preferences. And whilst we know that crises are increasingly protracted and the need for long-term funding is widely known, funding cycles remain short and quite unpredictable. That really is hindering a wider support of well-being. And again, this kind of echoes the first recommendation, where there's a need to really bring affected people into that decision making and to be able to direct resources towards what they believe is genuinely important for their well-being. International actors need to prioritize working with humanitarian actors. And more should be done by international actors to co-design activities with local humanitarian actors who hold this knowledge and foster opportunities for joint decision-making. Really critical to shift beyond the kind of bare minimum localization efforts, which often hinder systemic. Lastly, I know Nadia has already talked through this, but just to say, the policy brief suggests that international and local humanitarian actors must improve engagement and coordination with de facto state-like actors to really address the barriers to well-being, increase humanitarian response coherence, and enhance conflict sensitivity. Not simply about improving engagement with de facto states, but also advocating for donors for less onerous restrictions on such engagement. And this improved coordination can greatly contribute towards well-being, for improving basic service delivery, consolidating stabilization efforts, and it also allows for greater engagement on structural impediments like movement restrictions or the right to work. I will pass back to Justin.
Thank you for that presentation. As you'll see again, this issue around systemic those recommendations. Is really critical, and we encourage, you know, the take research like this to is like gradual shifts towards things such as multi-year financing, still so incremental. And before I hand over to Lynn, I think a lot of these issues as well might go, okay, is well-being a bit of a abstract, you know. And I think there's a lot of connections with ideas around gender as well. And it's not a whole bunch of additional money too, but it is a way of how you think about your programming, who you are consulting, how are you collecting disaggregated data, what data is important, how do you design. And well-being is kind of drawing on a lot of these issues. It's not inherently about more resources. How do you allocate those resources? How do you involve people in decision-making? How do you have a well-being? Anyway, I will leave it there and just sum up that these two research pieces, which we will share, are kind of the conclusion. Program, and that will be shifting from next month, 3-year research agenda around state-led. Builds upon this when we talk about, you know, all these issues around rights, authorities, around governance, politics, like really delving deeply into state-led humanitarian action is kind of the next phase of this long-term. If you want to reach out around the state-led humanitarian response, please get in contact, as we are excited to be pursuing that. Obviously, some states are quite evil. Anyway, I will hand over to Lynn, who's going to zoom out even further on a huge project she's been working on and recently published with the ISAC on the IDP review. And Lynn is also a research officer at HPG. Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you, Dustin. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining this event. Thank you, Alex and Nadia, for this thought-provoking presentations. So as Dustin mentioned, I'm going to be zooming out a bit and looking at the broader crisis of internal displacement. So in September 2021, the UN Secretary General's High-Level Panel on Internal Displacement published a report which laid out challenges faced by people displaced in their own countries. It made recommendations to improve the collective response to the global crisis of internal displacement. And based on those recommendations, the Interagency Standing Committee, or the ISC, or the EASC, commissioned an independent review of the humanitarian response to internal displacement to strengthen the ability of humanitarian actors to protect, assist, and support solutions for IDPs. The humanitarian policy group here at ODI, alongside a group of experts, have carried out this review, which essentially focuses on improving protection and assistance for IDPs, paving the way for durable solutions. Next slide, please. So when the ISC started looking at the issue of internal displacement 30 years ago, numbers of IDPs were around 20 million. Today, or in fact, last year's numbers reached 71 million IDPs. And this is not going to slow down. In Syria, for example, one in three of all those remaining in their country were still internally displaced at the end of 2022, after more than a decade of conflict. The World Bank estimates that internal displacement will reach 220 million people by 2050, which will be significantly impacted by the climate crisis. So we know that numbers will increase, especially given new and renewed conflicts and disasters that took place in 2023, including in Sudan, Gaza, and elsewhere. And this is all happening against a backdrop of a very constrained humanitarian system and constrained funding, as we've also heard in the last two presentations. And IDPs constitute a quarter of the humanitarian caseload. These are some of the most vulnerable people in need of assistance. Next slide, please. So we've conducted an extensive literature review, which looked at some of the published literature, grey literature, UN mandates, IDP policies, and that helped us set the framework for the rest of the review. We've also had six country case studies as the core of our data collection, and they were Mozambique, Honduras, DRC, Yemen, Nigeria, and Ethiopia. We've also interviewed 1,500 IDPs, and this was a priority for us to talk to people who are internally displaced themselves. We've talked to 700 colleagues and stakeholders in the IDP responses across those countries, including governments, people working in the humanitarian sector, donor agencies, and civil society. And we've had a rigorous consultation process with global stakeholder colleagues, and we've had an excellent reference group, which included agencies, donors, and people in leadership positions. Can you go to the next slide, please? So as you would imagine, there were many findings and accordingly many recommendations, but the gist is that the ISC system is not responding effectively to the global crisis of internal displacement. While IDPs are largely the responsibility of affected governments, however, the humanitarian system is critical when governments are unwilling or unable to respond. But the system is often too slow to respond to IDP crises. We've seen in DRC, it took 8 months to launch an emergency appeal for the nearly 600,000 people displaced in northern Kivu. In Mozambique, we also saw that it took 4 years for the system to respond collectively in the north to the conflict and displacement crisis. So the system is very slow in responding to the crises. When it does respond, the system is not joined up. And this is a very critical point given that it's a collaborative effort. The system overlooks IDP's specific needs, for example, needs for shelter, for solution, for protection, for livelihoods and education, because it tends to focus on the sector, on one sector per mandated agency or per cluster, and it doesn't manage to join the dots and look at IDP's specific needs. So we've seen that needs are falling through the cracks. And finally, the system focuses on internal processes than meaningful engagement with affected people. Sorry, there was one last point that I forgot to mention. The system is too slow to help IDPs get their lives back on track. The default has often been aid until the money runs out, not until needs are met. Can you go to the next slide, please? We've consistently found that IDPs are asking for support that strengthens their education and livelihoods, which resonates a lot with the well-being project. Education, civil documentation, housing, land, property rights, and livelihoods that are currently considered as beyond life-saving assistance are seen by the broader humanitarian community as lower priority development issues, but they're actually an essential part of a solutions-oriented response. We've seen that the humanitarian system is built around the logic of life-saving assistance, but in practice, the times when it is actually called on to really save lives are rare. And as we've seen in this review, when it is genuinely called on to do so, it is often late, chaotic, and uncoordinated. We've seen that, for example, in Syria with the late, slow, and uncoordinated earthquake response. The majority of cases, however, the humanitarian system engaged in something better described as care and maintenance. And this is a mode in which it is primarily engaged in the biggest humanitarian crises by dollar value across the world, for example, in Syria, Yemen, Afghanistan, Somalia, Ukraine, DRC, Ethiopia, who are all currently in receipt of over $1 billion this year and over $2 billion last year. And most of these countries have been in the emergency appeals system for years, but this emergency funding is leading to standardized emergency type interventions, like, for example, NFI, hygiene kits, food rations, emergency toilets, and so on. But what we've seen throughout the review and throughout the well-being project, almost immediately, IDPs want to establish a viable life for themselves. In fact, they have no choice because aid at best simply fills some gaps. IDPs want jobs, education, safety, but what they're getting are hygiene kits and food handouts. And this is a function of a broken system. But that's why delivering a joined up response is critical to meet IDPs' multiple and interconnected needs. As I mentioned before, IDPs have specific needs for water, food, shelter, livelihoods, education, protection, etc. But it's a lottery as to which one they are getting at the moment. And finally, one of the biggest findings is that IDPs are not being involved in the decision making. Their agency and capacity remains largely overlooked. Can you please go to the next slide? We talked to IDPs and they told us that they didn't feel they were being listened to, their priorities were not being reflected, and more importantly, their capacities were not being engaged. But the lack of attention to IDP voices is especially ironic given that the 1,500 IDPs we consulted for the study are overwhelmingly asking for support that strengthens their sense of agency and resilience, but which the humanitarian system is not able or willing to provide. So as you can see from the quotes, there are a lot of similarities between these IDPs in Nigeria and Mozambique and the quotes that are coming out of Northeast Syria. So you can see mentioned hardship, no sense of future, no aspirations, they feel they're forgotten, they fear they're invisible, their voices are not being heard or listened to, or even ignored. Next slide, please. How do we go forward from there? So what we're recommending is not a wholesale overhaul of the system. Instead, we are strengthening and sharpening some of the elements we think are most important to IDP responses. So we focus very much on just trying to get the emergency response coordinator and the EASC to take IDPs seriously, to bring back IDPs as an area of focus and to see themselves as championing the response. And that has been a success for now. ERC Martin Griffiths launched the review in March, and he reiterated the EASC commitment to bring back IDPs as an area of focus. The review has been discussed at the principals and EASC deputies level, and it will be kept on the agenda for a while. On the ground, we've recommended enhancing the resident coordinator, humanitarian coordinator authority. They need to be able to quickly fire up the system after mass displacement. They also need to have the authority, not just on paper, but in practice, and to ensure a joined up response. They need to focus on IDP specific needs by ensuring a better and timelier protection response. The system also needs to better lay out the groundworks for solution through concentrating on giving people agency and choice from the beginning. It also needs to do that by supporting livelihoods, education, and rights as a priority and not an afterthought as it is currently doing. And it also needs to put IDPs at the center of the response. I think you've heard us all say that over and over again, but this is a very important point because it needs to genuinely and meaningfully engage IDPs. It needs to better support local organizations and better use of empowering aid such as cash. And to the final slide, please. There are actually 41 recommendations, but we've tried to highlight the most important ones or priority recommendations. So I'm going to summarize what I've just said in the previous slide. So there needs to be a systemic focus by the ISC led by the principals. We need to enhance RCHC authority to lead the system. They need to have real power to arrange coordination system and to hold the system to account. The system needs to center IDP priorities, and there needs to be humanitarian diplomacy in the most difficult cases. We've seen that in a lot of cases, affected governments struggle with displacement, or governments are actually involved in displacement. And leaving the IDP caseload to governments alone who don't want to confront their own IDP crises is not good enough, especially in terms of rights and protection. So we need to be able to call on high-level diplomacy to unlock those key moments. There needs to be new financing modalities, particularly for IDPs in protracted crises. Aid until the money runs out is neither helping IDPs nor it is cost efficient. To call something emergency on an annual basis, especially, you know, in Syria, it's been 12 years. So we can't just keep calling it emergency every single year. We need to invest in early capacities and agencies of IDPs to help themselves, and therefore they don't need our assistance. These issues are not new, but they are coming up front and center in the analysis of this report. We need to also have solution strategies right from the beginning. For example, by establishing a durable solutions working group early in an IDP crisis, sometime in the first 6 months, it should be convened under the authority of the RCHC, and it should have development agencies such as UNDP, UN Habitat, and also includes human rights actors. This was a lot, so I will hand over to Dustin to lead the moderation. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks, Lynn, for that very detailed, which that research is a, or from the level of consultations on the first slide. It is very comprehensive, very robust, and Lynn and the broader team have done some excellent analysis. So please scan the QR code, but you'll also receive a copy. So we've got about half an hour remaining to kind of open it up to discussion. We prompt questions both from in the room and also online. We will try and go one for one to make it as equitable as possible. We know there's a lot of consistent themes coming through some of the research, which is also why we presented the research together. Hello? 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 Sorry, 1 second. They can still hear us online. What's happened with the sound? Anyway, I'll speak very loudly. Oh, there we go. The sound is now back in line. Sorry for all the technical difficulties today. So we're basically going to open the floor to Q&A, anything related to the three research pieces, of which there was a lot of common themes across. We recognize there is a blend of practitioners, geographic focuses, people working on policy, advocacy. So we welcome any kind of direction in terms of questions. But we also encourage, this is kind of a bit of a moment, and we have some of the luxury at HPG is to kind of, we're often so involved in the dance floor, responding to crisis after crisis, new dynamics, cuts in funding. This is also an opportunity to kind of, you know, take a step up to the balcony and kind of think about some of these more holistic or more policy advocacy kind of issues as well. So we encourage balcony view analysis or questions. So I'll hand it over. There's no questions online yet. So if anybody in the room, please jump in and please use your microphone so that online can hear you as well. Thanks.
Solutions platform, which dwindling resources and a growing number of
give any indication of how we should we can identify basically
Thanks for the question. Apparently online could not hear, so I will do a quick repeat. We'll do one question at a time, otherwise my brain cannot compute. So just to repeat it for online, it's basically a question from the Regional Durable Solutions Working Group of how do we kind of navigate this issue around prioritization when you have so many competing demands and different ideas for safety, whether that's physical safety, legal safety, you know, broader protection concerns as well. So if anybody would like to jump in, Lean or Nadia online, perhaps, would be great to hear from you. Sorry, it was not the Regional Durable Solutions Working Group, my Durable Solutions platform. Sorry, I've obviously been too long out of the sector and have forgot my acronym capacities. Anyway, please jump in with a response, Nadia or Lean. Thank you.
I think one thought, it's a hard question, I think, but one thought I was thinking links to sort of Lean's recommendations about having a more maybe linked up sense of the durable solutions and having more of the actors involved to sort of, you know, the humanitarian development, human rights, to be able to sort of put together a strategy that kind of incorporates all of that in a bit more of a cohesive way. I think it's difficult because there's so many different needs and it gets stretched and how do things work? But I think having a more linked up system would partly help with some of that to understand kind of where there is commonality or where there could be pooled resources. I think this came out of Northeast Syria, for instance, when we were talking. They are quite constrained, but some of the work that stabilization actors or funds go to are similar to the work that is actually the humanitarians are doing. And so would there be a way to pool those to cover more places and then to encompass also potentially more needs and more rights and understanding kind of what is important to people and sort of joining up in that way? It could be a possibility. I think that it's hard because yes, everyone has different approaches and different sort of mandates on how they do things, but maybe being more flexible about sort of what that could look like and who works with whom within the sectors may be worth considering as well, I think.
Thanks for that, Nadia. Lean, did you want to add anything on top of that?
Just wanted to reiterate what Nadia said and also say, as ever, as we're recommending in the IDP review, we've seen that the system is taking too long to respond to crises. So because we need to, you know, in as I mentioned, in DRC, it took 6 months. In Mozambique, it took 4 years. So when there are crises, the system is not responding fast enough or even joined up. So I think this is the key. It is a difficult question. We won't be able to, it's really hard to kind of prioritize in this day and age because there are multiple crises, even in, you know, for example, the Middle East region, there are multiple crises right now. So I think the system needs to be better joined up. It needs to link up with development actors from the beginning because humanitarians can't take everything on their own. They need to link up with development actors to pass them the baton when it is time for development actors to step up. They need to also prioritize these beyond life-saving assistance that we've mentioned, livelihoods, education, to get their IDPs back on their feet. I think this is in the thing that we're recommending from the review. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks, Lynn. We will take one question from online, but I'd also emphasize a lot of what came through of the various pieces of research is really around accountability to affected populations. So that kind of implies or is very direct of like who decides on prioritization. Often donors are pushing this idea, funding is limited, you need to prioritize, but then also how do you ensure, you know, people affected by crisis, displaced populations, how are they involved in the decision-making to prioritize what they want to receive? I think Lynn used the excellent example of priority for what they wanted. So ensuring there are mechanisms for that effective input from affected populations. I remember particularly in contexts like the Rohingya crisis in Cox's Bazar, there was complaint boxes everywhere and mobile phone numbers that people could call with the complaint line, feedback line written in English, population that was illiterate, access to mobile phones. And so unsurprisingly, there was also no feedback or no direction to the response. It's also making, you know, accountability to affected populations accessible. All right, so we have a question online. We're gonna go one in person, one online. So the question, sharing it for everyone here, other than rigid budgetary cycles, what are possible factors inhibiting donors from funding multi-year programs? Any ideas on how to support continuity of impact assessments over the medium term in the absence of significant funding? Question online. I might hand that over to Alex to start with, but Nadia and Lynn also please jump in.
I think I need to put my guy hat back on. I think it's, again, a lot of science structural issues, being able to use kind of move past that. There's a lot of work being able to move past that, but I think the longer term, I think generally just isn't very comfortable at the moment for a lot of donors. I think who are working domestic policies reasons, I guess, working to much shorter timeframes. I have forgotten the back end of that question, but I guess it's just trying to move forward with the kind of broader system. There are obviously clear examples of the value of doing so, and a lot of, I guess, from other work that I've been doing on refugee-led organizations, it's about building a lot of trust between donors and the organizations that they're trying to fund, in order to kind of push through some of those barriers. Some of the bigger organizations that are a part of the response have those quite healthy relationships with donors. They know who they are. They fit with compliance. They know that they can adhere to these compliance and due diligence requirements. Smaller organizations are working over a longer period of time, you know, that takes a little while to build up that trust. So I guess there's a bit of an ask to invest in the trust and the time that takes in order to do so. Particularly, I guess, when you're working with smaller organizations who maybe have not previously been given that opportunity. Offer it to Lynn or Nadia if they want to come in as well.
I can go ahead. So yeah, as you mentioned, humanitarian funding is somewhere between 6 and 12 months, and there's a lack of flexibility in how money is spent, which means that humanitarian actors are often stuck in providing basic and short-term emergency support in contexts, particularly where IDPs are asking for more solutions-oriented assistance. I think there needs to be the funding architecture kind of needs to change and needs to move on beyond the life-saving phase. There needs to be more effort between donors and the EASC leadership to bring on more longer-term and more appropriate funding, because more and more crises are becoming protracted situations. So I think there needs to be a recognition that these crises are not just, they're not going to just end, as we've seen in other projects. They are actually coming back you know, some conflicts have been frozen. For example, in Syria, is considered a frozen conflict, but is actually coming back to the forefront. In Palestine, in Gaza was considered a frozen conflict. It is coming back. So I think there needs to be a recognition that conflict, not just on paper, again, that these are protracted crises and protracted situations, but there needs to be a real recognition by the system and the donor governments, and there needs to be coordination between them.
Excellent. Thanks for those inputs, Lean. We might throw it to another question in the room because I saw Stephanie from ICFA putting up her hand. And please try to keep it relatively concise because I will have to repeat it.
Also, has this report looked at task force are all coming to an end in June? What does that mean for focus? I mean, where do we pitch?
All right, Lean, that was for you. Did you hear that by any chance?
No, not at all.
Okay, that's all right. I will try to repeat it as best as possible. So the question was, in the IDP review, you had issues around the joined up response, and that was very, you know, kind of a nexus orientated discussion. And then there has been a lot of consultations and alleged attempts at progress by Martin Griffiths and others to kind of push various reforms. Flagship initiative wasn't mentioned, but the, you know, that being one of many different efforts to kind of address these AAP issues and other aspects and working across the nexus. But there seems to be a lack of accountability on the progress, particularly around the RCs, HCs, and, you know, who's kind of holding them to account, or what kind of possibilities are there to kind of hold some of those systemic actors to better account? And the task force on AAP, like, how has that been involved in the report, or does the report speak to the task force on AAP? And what happens when that task force ends, which is fairly eminent? So a lot to unpack. Feel free to focus on whatever you remember. Thanks, Lynn.
Thank you. Yes, there have been issues around the joined up response, and there have been various consultations with senior humanitarians and Martin Griffith to push these reforms, but even to bring back IDPs as an area of focus. The flagship, we have been coordinating closely with the flagship initiative, with Robert Piper's initiative, which is actually around mostly around putting IDPs at the center. For example, one of our top line recommendations to center IDPs, which is also at the heart of the flagship initiative. So there needs to be more flexible, responsive, and contextualized EASC humanitarian response. In terms of empowering, in terms of holding RCHC to account, I think the first point is to empower them to kind of, as I mentioned, fire up the system, to tell them that this is your job. It is right now on paper, but a lot of the RCHCs are having to deal with a lot of other issues, not just the IDP response. So just kind of initially to empower them to lead the IDP response, but this should be coming from the top. It should be coming from the humanitarian, the IASC system itself. And I actually forgot the rest of the question.
Sorry, that was great, Lane. I'll see if Nadia, did you want to add anything? Otherwise, we can jump to another question.
No, I don't think I have anything. I just see my face on the screen. I don't think I have anything to add per se on this.
Okay, thanks. So there are no more questions online as yet. If you are online, we encourage you to please ask any simple, complicated, provocative questions. But we have another question in person. Can I maybe ask you to maybe come up here and speak into this microphone? Saves me. Okay, that's all right. You can sit and I can.
Well, firstly, my name is Dimitri. I work for Oxfam. Thank you very much for these three presentations. It was really nice to hear them. I think those presentations, they all come up with the really important takeaways and findings and recommendations, including things like sufficient longer-term donor funding, slowness in the response, lack of coordination, and all that. I agree, these are very important findings. At the same time, I've been feeling as a some sort of a deja vu, because there's been a lot of analysis and research on that matter over years. And if you look at the research, let's say 5, 10, 15, and even 20 years ago, you would find exactly the same takeaways. So I have a reflection and a question, if I may. So the reflection is about maybe we collectively, as people working in policy and advocacy, we need to be looking less at our policy asks rather than what needs to be done differently that we actually achieve the impact on the system and it starts reforming itself. Because the analysis is there. The analysis about what is wrong is there. And it has been there for a long while. But that was my reflection. And also another part of it is that we are in the Middle East. We're in Amman, where it is hard to avoid discussion about what is going on in Gaza. Would have been really nice to see some analysis on the Gaza response too. So, and then the question is, because I have a note, so I need to look at it. The question is related to the second presentation. I hope the note I made is reflecting well what has been said. There was a statement where the mentioned that humanitarian programming is undermining people's effort to reestablish normal lives. Would be really curious to hear more about that to understand what you exactly mean.
Excellent. Thank you, Dimitri. Apparently this microphone is much better online, so we will stick with running this microphone round. So thanks for those very poignant remarks. Sometimes we are stuck in inertia, or sometimes we are stuck in banging our head against the same brick wall over and over. So maybe I'll hand to Alex to talk a bit about that particular quote, and Nadia can probably jump in. And Lean and our broader team at HPG have been doing quite a lot of work around Gaza and a lot of the double standards and other issues there. So maybe Lean could jump in with a few thoughts there, which would be excellent. But I'll hand over to Alex now regarding that particular quote.
Thank you for that. I think it's quite, again, another complex question. And I'll try and speak to it as best as I can. But I guess a part of the issue is that we're framing that as if you don't consider well-being, then, or a well-being approach, or understanding the complexities that go behind a well-being approach, including more than just somebody's material needs, then perhaps you In that sense, humanitarian assistance can kind of prevent someone from being able to reestablish their normal life. And I'm just trying to think of a couple of examples of maybe where that came up in. And I guess this is where it's kind of hard to separate out again the kind of politics of response or politics, domestic politics, from humanitarian assistance. But I guess if you have been displaced and you're living in a camp, like some of the people our researchers were speaking to in Thailand, you know, you can't go out and get job opportunities. You are kind of restricted somewhere to the place that you can live, and the education that is on offer to you or is not on offer to you more often than not, in the sense that, like, you know, funding cycles are short. There's no long-term funding. There's no guaranteed funding. Sometimes programs are just cut. Sometimes you're in school one day and then maybe not the next month. And your normal life would be to be able to kind of have a full education. And so it's not necessarily that humanitarian assistance in itself always prevent somebody from reestablishing a normal life, but almost the fluctuations in the system and the prioritization of issues like education that mean so much to the people that we spoke to, that prevents them from reestablishing a normal life. I'm sure Nadia has so many more examples. She was leading the Nest case study in particular as well. So I think she will probably have more examples of maybe where that comes up. So I just want to turn to her to kind of offer the opportunity to kind of speak to those.
I'll speak to it. It's a little bit complicated with Kamishli because, to be honest, there hasn't been any aid response directed there in a consistent way. I think it comes through some assistance to IDPs that's usually run by the UN, but through sort of government of Syria registered local partners. But there, it's sort of almost like when we talk to people about it, it's like sort of meaningless. It's random. It doesn't get delivered very much. It's food baskets. People need help with that, but they need more than that. And they talk about that. So what aid is coming is sort of helpful, but it's not the needs that they have. And I think actually more to the point, I think I work a lot on Iraq as well. And that response, the international response, the Nexus response, has very much focused on displacement crisis after the ISIS conflict. And when you talk to people displaced and returning populations, you know, it's interesting how they consider aid organizations that are there. They're like, well, this is helpful. I mean, it's good that they're here. But what they need to survive is not the aid that's being given. Like, they talk about more structural issues that I think sometimes they feel like, well, the aid organizations are here and so they're helpful, but we need the government to do these other things that are not happening. And because the aid is there, it's sort of almost like that's the response. You know what I'm saying? Like, the aid is sort of, we're going to do these things, and these underlying issues that affect their well-being, their ability to sort of flourish, be able to move around better. I think it's shifting. I think there's now, Iraq is one of the countries that is part of that special sort of agenda to kind of deal with the remaining protracted displacement that links to civil documentation. I think that's been a big, big push. But other types of rights issues that go beyond the scope of humanitarian action, but that there is still quite a big humanitarian presence. Like, it's aid actors that are still providing aid, and people think it's important, but it's not what they need. And they talk about that. Like, what we need is sort of a political resolution to who's in charge of security here, so that we can come back, or lifting, you know, impediments that are broader than that. And that if those things are gone, then we can actually sort of move our lives forward a bit more. And they can't access those. So they're doing what they can with what they have, and aid is helpful. I mean, aid is, you know, provided, but it's not, they recognize it as helpful, but it's not like, it's not the thing that's going to sort of change my life here. And it's not the thing that's going to be able to help me flourish. It's just, it's it's just here. And sometimes it's here in the, as in a way to not actually respond to the other needs, kind of. It's seen in that way a little bit.
Excellent. Thanks so much for that, Nadia. Very well articulated. We'll hand over to Lean for a few brief comments about Gaza and some of the excellent work she's been doing. And then I'll do a final wrap up because we are nearing or just over time. So Lean, thanks.
Thanks, Dustin. Yeah, as Dustin mentioned, we've been doing a lot of work around Gaza in the Humanitarian Policy Group. And we all know that Gaza has produced hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of new internal displacements. It's a huge humanitarian crisis, but it's also a political crisis. More and more humanitarian crises are becoming political crises. And there's a big question that we're grappling with when it comes to Gaza, which is who will be filling the gap in governance once hostilities subside. As Nadia mentioned, there are governance security issues, not just humanitarian issues. So who will be governing these Gazans' IDPs when the hostilities subside? We can see the issue being mirrored in Northwest Syria or the border population in Myanmar. So humanitarian aid will run out. As I've mentioned in my presentation, aid is until the money runs out. But the longer term solutions will require a political solution, which will have to be in coordination with authorities, development actors, and the broader humanitarian system. Thank you, Dustin.
Cool. Thanks for that, Lena. And again, obviously some deep political issues that are very difficult to address as any humanitarian actor. But important not to shy away. And I know you mentioned, Dimitri, you're from Oxfam and the importance of engaging in some of these advocacy issues, political dynamics, calling for ceasefires, but also calling for longer term political solutions. I think this also came up a bit in the research as well, is how much does the humanitarian sector kind of perpetuate the encampment or protracted displacement without ever doing enough to really go, okay, how do we achieve durable solutions? How do we advocate with local authorities or non-state authorities or state authorities to really kind of move beyond this protracted long-term displacement that is so prevalent across the world? Our time is up. So first of all, I would like to apologize for some of the sound connectivity issues online. We are in a venue that is not a HPG ODI venue, so we've had a few difficulties there. Thank you for your patience. There is a online feedback form, which would be excellent. For those in person, there is also a paper old school form, which we would strongly encourage you to fill out. Obviously, some of those questions may not be particularly spicy, but they are what our donors like to have filled out. And I'd like to say thank you to all our panelists and their presentations of the various research. So we had Nadia Siddiqui from Social Inquiry, and so please reach out to her subsequently, that they do a lot of great research and has been great to partner with them at HPG. Alexandra Spencer, who's here as a senior research officer and involved in a lot of the wellbeing research, and Lean Fouad, who's a research officer also with HPG. And yeah, just thank them all for taking their time and putting a lot of thought, not just into the presentations, but this has been like a long-term research agenda dealing with quite sensitive and quite complicated issues. So, and thanks also to all the staff at HPG behind the scenes, the communications teams, the AV teams, everybody else who've kind of made this event happen. So, and finally to the audience, thank you for tuning in, and please read through the research, please share it through your networks, and please leverage it for your own influencing, whether that's with RCs, HCs, whether that's with donors, because you know these systems don't change by research existing in a vacuum, but really trying to leverage research for influence. And I will leave it there. And for those in person, we welcome you to a free lunch. So please join us for that and be good to chat further about some of the issues. And otherwise, that is it. Thank you very much, everyone.